States, which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former US President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The U.S. is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The U.S. should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the U.S. decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for. And you would see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions. So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances, and our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario, but we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new US President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over. They stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop. And Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the US ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable so long as the Ansarullah-held areas are sanctioned. Robert Carter, London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has rolled out issuing an official apology for the atrocities committed by French troops in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the deadly eight-year war that ended 132 years of French rule in the North African country. Algeria has been demanding a formal apology for years for France's colonial-era war crimes. The French presidency, however, said France will instead endeavor to face up to its history. The statement comes ahead of the publication of a major government commission report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. The report offers proposal to address long-standing grievances, but it skirts the issue of systematic torture by French troops and does not recommend an official apology. France occupied Algeria in 1830. The African country gained independence following the Algerian War of 1954 to 1962. The war is also known as the Algerian Revolution. Algerian historians put the death toll at 1.5 million Algerian victims, while the French historians say around 400,000 people from both sides were killed in the conflict. The truth of the colonization and the War of Independence lay buried for decades. During his presidential campaign in 2017, Macron called the colonization of Algeria a crime against humanity. In September 2018, he officially acknowledged for the first time the widespread use of torture by French forces in the former colony. However, like his predecessors, Macron has so far refrained from issuing a formal apology for his country's colonial past. But grievances tied to the colonial history have weighed on French national integration, since many French citizens are Muslims of Algerian descent. As former Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner admitted in 2008, there seems to be a permanent contradiction between human rights and the foreign policy of France. The country's dark history of human rights violations and supporting dictators, especially in Africa and West Asia, serves as proof of Kouchner's remark that a French foreign policy is not based on human rights. France's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during his invasion of Iran in the 1980s, its support for Libya's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi before his ouster in 2011, and the country's arms sales to Saudi Arabia while the kingdom is involved in the brutal war on Yemen are all indicative of such a policy. It so appears that human rights is only a weapon in the hands of French politicians to target nations that do not get along with their policies.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. My country, Iran, is a vast land with four seasons. The four-season feature in Iran brings about the experience of winter tourism in one place and summer tourism in another at the same time. For example, rain, wavy seas, storm, beautiful rivers, desert. All and all are available in just one land. Today, we are going to visit northwest of Iran to see one of the wonders of this region, the Takht-e-Suleyman Lake of Takab. Takht-e-Suleyman, meaning Throne of Solomon, is an archaeological site in West Azerbaijan province, which used to be known as Ganjak very long time ago. Today, this region is called Takht-e-Suleyman. Takht-e-Suleyman site is 45 kilometers northeast of the city of Takab. The ancient area of Takht-e-Suleyman includes Sassanid and Ilkhanid gates, Azargoshasp fire temple, and Anahita temple. At the center of this archaeological site, there is a lake which is actually the beating heart of this historical complex. The Takht-e-Suleyman lake is a calcium-rich spring with thousands of years of age, which outflows water rigorously from the deep underground water. The water, which boils at a depth of more than 120 meters, is saturated with minerals so that it cannot be used for drinking or farming. I am now in the area of Takht-e-Suleyman. It's really cold in here. I'd better wear my gloves. There is snow everywhere, and the scenery is really fascinating. I have to walk further to reach the lake. Spectacular! The amount of minerals in the lake is so much, so it is not possible to dive or even see through the depth of the lake. That is why they say there is secrets about this lake. And there are also local legends. There is a story which says, one Solomon struck his stick to the ground, and a spring started flowing and created the lake, which today is called Takht-e-Suleyman. And here, there is a notice. Oh, well, I'm not wearing my glasses, so I have to get close to see what's written. It reads, no swimming. Of course, no one ever swims in such a freezing weather. Oh, well, what's this? Oh, God, it's a gravestone. This grave belongs to a person who has gone swimming in the lake and drowned. In this season, which sunlight reflects off the snow, steam rise off the lake. It's a really mysterious and enchanting scenery. I can't take my eyes off of these beauties. I'd like to stand here forever and stare at this foggy lake. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. A new U.S. administration has come to power, but accusations against Washington seem to be quite familiar. Again, the U.S. is being accused of interfering in a sovereign country. This time it is Russia, where some demonstrations have taken place protesting the arrest of opposition figure Alexei Navalny on his return from Germany. Moscow has pointed the finger at Washington and trying to fuel the flames of protests in Russia. This coming at a time that Moscow says it is ready to talk to the Biden administration about improving ties. Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate. We're going to start it off in Moscow and talk to our correspondent on the ground there, Marina Kortanova. Marina, great to have you with us. Well, fill us in on this latest situation and the accusations by Moscow of U.S. interference.
So thousands in major cities of Russia yesterday joined protest in support not only of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny, but against impoverishment of the population in the country, lack of production and unemployment, disagreeing with the policy of the current authorities and against the irremovability of the latter, as well as inflation, failed youth and social policy. Some scuffles and detentions took place. As you know, Alexei Navalny is a Russian opposition leader who heads the Anti-Corruption Foundation. He films investigations. Two of the latter caused the greatest resonance in Russian society. Meanwhile, the day earlier, the U.S. Embassy in Moscow posted detailed information on its website regarding the time and locations of the mass rallies. Russian presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov has described these statements as interference in the country's domestic affairs. The U.S. Embassy claimed to monitor the protests across Russia and accused the Russian authorities of suppressing free speech and free assembly. Peskov said that it is hard to imagine if Russian embassy had reacted in such manner when the United States experienced civil unrest. Then it would have caused certain discomfort in Washington. He also said that he always feels like recommending counterparts to imagine themselves in such a situation. Earlier, Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs made a statement that such comprehensive information goes beyond the concern about the well-being of U.S. citizens in Russia and goes in line with Washington's provocative and dogmatic policy of encouraging protests in countries whose governments are seen by the United States as undesirable.
Okay.
Any attempts to provide such coverage regarding unauthorized rallies to be deemed as blatant interference in Russia's country's domestic affairs and will provoke an appropriate response.
Okay, Marina, good. Marina, thanks so much for that update on the situation. That's our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortanova. I'd like to welcome my first guest to the program, Don DeBar, activist and commentator out of New York. Don, always a pleasure to have you on. Well, Don, it just sounds like copy-paste. I mean, it seems like we've been there before. Your take on all of this and the possibility of U.S. Stirring up the flames there now in Russia.
Well, first of all, thank you, Marcy. A pleasure to be here with you. You know, the Russians with this Novichok poison, and if they wanted to do it right, they should come to the United States. You know, we have Monsanto. They never miss when you want to poison someone. They poison millions at a time. This is the first weekend after the new administration. For 4 years, I've been trying to point out to people and others as well that when we left off on January 19th, 2017, when the Obama administration left off, was with Russia surrounded by U.S. forces from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, under constant war games, diplomats being expelled, you know, by the handful, rhetoric that's started in mid, I would say, in 2014, and then in July of 2016 during the campaign, really aggressive, calling Russia every kind of evil and accusing it of attempting essentially to overthrow the government of the United States, which it was claimed by such as Clapper and others, head of CIA, DNI, FBI, that actually had occurred with Donald Trump, that Donald Trump was placed in office on January 20th, 2017 by Vladimir Putin, and that he was his puppet. We heard accusations on the editorial page of the New York Times when Trump met with Putin and didn't punch him in the face, that this was treason, he should be removed and tried, and you know there's death penalty for treason. So the first weekend after Biden takes office under this cloud, we have an uprising, quote unquote, of several thousand in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and a couple of smaller cities across Russia, coordinated, widely publicized, advance warning, by the way, from the State Department to Americans traveling in Russia that this was going to happen. But the maximum expression of what looks like the beginning of an attempted color revolution in Russia by the United States. That happening on the first day of the Biden administration, we were concerned that they might get aggressive with Russia and even stumble into a war is frightening, to use the simple word.
All right. Well, let me welcome my next guest out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster. Thanks so much for being with us, Jonathan. Well, you heard Don kick off the program and say basically we've picked up, it seems, from where the U.S. left off 4 years ago in dealing with Russia. Your take on all this? I mean, it appears very reminiscent of 2014 Ukraine, when the U.S. was exposed for its involvement in protests, and even American officials participated in demonstrations there, cursed the EU for not being on the same page. Your take on this, and why does it seem that Washington uses the same playbook time and time again in different countries?
Well, I tend to feel that it's actually a coincidence that this has happened at the first week of the Biden presidency. We have to remember that it was triggered by Alexei Navalny's return to Russia a few days ago, and then his arrest, and then the demonstrations that have taken place across Russia. I don't think this is an American-inspired counter-protest or okay. color revolution, as Don put it. Mm-hmm. I think that, frankly, it's quite normal for the Americans to put out a release, as they did to their citizens, to say, avoid these places. There are going to be demonstrations. There will probably be arrests, as indeed there were well over 1,000 people picked up for what was described as an unauthorized protest. But I think actually the climate for U.S.-Russian relations is actually got a boost by the arrival of Biden, who's a much more level-headed figure than Donald Trump ever was. And indeed, the Russians themselves, just over the last 48 hours or so, congratulated Joe Biden for suggesting prolonging the nuclear arms treaty for another 5 years and agreed that that would be a jolly good thing to do.
Well, what about that, Don? Because on the one hand, of course, we saw Trump or the Trump administration do some definitely off-the-wall things. But on the other hand, Trump continually wanted to have good relations with Moscow. But as you said, you pointed out that from the very beginning, he was told that the Russians had tried to interfere in the elections and that he was a spy. It just seemed to be this pull in not allowing that administration to establish closer ties. How do you see it?
First, behavior has in the context of votes in Congress. The first being the vote on sanctions, that sanctions bill that was proposed by Congress on its own initiative, adding sanctions against Russia, against Korea, and against Iran to the pile that had already existed, almost directly in response to Trump's pronouncements about Russia, that it would be good if the U.S. and Russia had better relations and not a bad thing. His actual movement towards relations and his visit ultimately to North Korea, and his failure to act on the aggressive rhetoric that he had tossed at Iran up to that point by passing a sanctions bill on the order of 517-6 or something, which is not only veto-proof but practically unanimous. That first vote telegraphed what policy was going to be, and the second one was the vote on his impeachment, which, you know, passed the House and was close enough in the Senate to be discouraging. He was looking at his foreign policy essentially being at the sufferance of Congress and his removal being an immediate tool that they would have available. And you can look at the speed by which that Ukrainian pause for his ultimate impeachment matured from the occurrence until the actual vote as you know, an indication of how tight a leash he was on. So on the one hand, even though the U.S. Continued to either allow nuclear treaties with Russia to expire and even further abrogated some or withdrew from some, a lot of the content that was actually happening around those had to do with obsolete treaties. For example, the treaty that dealt with cruise missiles was critical in the 1980s, but the technology is obsolete. You can have that treaty in place and still have 9 minutes or so from launch to demolition in Russia or the United States with the weapons that have been developed since. Trump's behavior was that he shut down the war games. That all by itself dropped the level of readiness of troops on both sides and the risk of accidental war, which is where I see the real risk of nuclear war coming, you know, being accidental, but a consequence of, you know, complete, total criminal negligence on the part of the United States by forcing a level of hostilities okay. Where everything air trigger.
Well, Jonathan, you said that you just thought that all of this is the timing was accidental. I mean, we look at Navalny's return to Russia. This is after accusing the government of being behind his poisoning. Do you not find it curious that he would return and that he would return at this time? And then we see these protests basically sprouting up in various cities?
No, I think it was a reasonable time to go back for him once he had recovered fully from the poisoning that and the treatment that he underwent in Germany. So I don't find the timing strange for him to go back to Moscow at this stage. What is really interesting, though, is that whereas Alexei Navalny was very much a fringe figure a few years ago and not all that many people would supported him, that situation has obviously changed. Because even though, obviously, Vladimir Putin decided that Navalny should not be allowed to contest the presidential election, nonetheless, Navalny has obviously got several thousand supporters. One can't accurately judge how many who've gone out knowing full well that if they did go out in unauthorized protests, as they're called, they would be likely to get arrested, including his wife, of course, Yulia. So I don't think it's as sinister or as worrying as really one should feel. And I was encouraged by the fact that the Kremlin actually did say, having reprimanded the American embassy for putting out the detail of the route of one of the protests in Moscow, the Kremlin then did say what they hoped was that there would be new talks with Washington, and that the way to solve problems is through negotiation. And that I absolutely endorse.
Well, let's talk about that, Don, actually what Jonathan has just said, that in the middle of all of this and seeing these demonstrations basically increase and feeling that the United States is behind them, at the same time, Russian officials have said that they would welcome talks with the Biden administration. Your assessment of that?
First of all, just things in context. If there were kind of media support of the protests that took place in, well, let's even back up. Let's go to the period, say, from December 12th until January 6th. Just prior to when the Electoral College met, up until the time that the joint session of Congress took place and the so-called attempted coup, when the guy with the horns and 100 of his friends stormed the Capitol with flags and urine and balloons or whatever else they had. If there were analogous support for that from Russian media to the American audience, to that which has been beamed at the Russian audience in support of Navalny through this entire episode, and any other opposition figure that could be found, you would have a tremendous outcry from the U.S. government that this was constituted, someone like the senator from New Hampshire, for example, that this constitutes an act of war. Gene Shanine. The scale of activity in the United States that provokes, another Patriot Act, essentially. 100 people storm the gates of the Capitol and do nothing other than get shot. One of them beats a cop to death. But, this is something that is blown out of proportion, as if, we were under threat of being taken over by a foreign power. Meanwhile, the support that's given to this, there are parades on behalf of the Communist Party, which gets a third of the vote in every election in Russia, that never make the air in the United States, let alone make Russian air via U.S. media. This is the context for it. What's going on is an attempt by U.S. intelligence agencies to pressure the Russian government with the threat of a color revolution. That's how it's seen in Russia, although the threat is not seen as much as Langley would like it to be, because Navalny really is still a fringe character, and that whatever he represents still has essentially a fringe following. But the attempt has already been made, and the first shot fired over the bow that, okay, this is a new sheriff in town, and we're coming in for the things we want.
Okay.
It's already been told what they want: the oil, they want the gas. They want no competition on the global stage, and this is the first step. And they've already said more of this next week and the week after.
Well, Jonathan, in your perspective, how likely are we to see warmer relations between the U.S. and Russia now during this Biden administration?
I think we can be cautiously optimistic. I don't think we're going to see a great love-in between Washington and Moscow. But I do think the general tenor of Joe Biden's administration, assuming that it's going to be confirmed by the Senate, will be to have friendly relations with Russia, with some other countries around the world that are important in the world economy, and of course with the European Union in particular, which is a slight divergence from Donald Trump's priorities. I think also that we're seeing that Joe Biden very much wants to get away from this idea of a, America being isolated, being in difficult arrangements with other countries that are not suitable, not conducive to peace. And so I'm cautiously optimistic, but I don't think we should go over the top on this. I don't think we should say that we're ushering in a great new era of friendship. I think it's looking good.
Well, even if you, just staying with you, Jonathan, when we look at some of the remarks actually that Don made, and referring to the last administration of Obama, and he said it feels as if we've picked up from where we had left off. Your assessment of that, because if we look at the Democrats in general, what we saw and reaction by the Democrats and others towards Trump and saying that he wanted warmer relations with Moscow, it appears that the Democrats are actually the ones that have been against the warming of this relationship. And if we look at some of the individuals who are going to be serving in the cabinet, whether we're talking about Nuland or others, not a great track record when it comes to Russian affairs.
Well, certainly several of the people who are proposed for the new cabinet are indeed familiar faces from before Donald Trump's time. And of course, Biden was vice president to President Obama, so we maybe shouldn't be surprised by that continuity. So in that sense, yes, we've gone back to a certain period where of people who have the experience of those years. But I do think that nonetheless, the world atmosphere has changed over the last 4 years, and that although Donald Trump said that he wished to improve relations with Moscow, and that he said that he was going to get a nuclear deal with North Korea, which he didn't despite his high-profile summits, I think we have a recognized situation now where we'll go back to more of a world order in which there are more balanced decisions being taken. And I don't think that Joe Biden himself will want to say anything or do anything that would antagonize Moscow at the moment. We all accept Vladimir Putin is there, and so long as he wants to be there, he's going to remain there. So that it would be ridiculous for any outside power, including the United States, to try to urge people to get rid of him, because they won't. He still has an enormous amount of support.
Okay. Well, Don, can the U.S., in your perspective, establish mutual relations with countries and treat them as equals? Is this possible in your perspective?
I mean, it's always possible. Is it possible with the current leadership? I don't know. We have to look at the context under which this administration comes to power, and how the other one was driven from power. And the primary disagreement between those factions of whatever power elite exists here that was involved in it is over two different world views. One that Trump saw more as a multilateral view, where the players all have their own agency, and they're expected to pay their own way too, by the way. The disagreement, quote unquote, with the European countries, for example, was actually a disagreement with that part of the European elites that have the Atlanticist point of view, the international view, with the U.S. as a global hegemon and everyone having a respective place as a higher or lower level vassal. The view that Trump had was one more of multilateral, and the view that was in power for a long time since World War II, particularly since 1991, the fall of the USSR, was the hegemonic one. The hegemonic one is now back in power. Where does that leave Russia? It leaves Russia to do what it's told, shut up and sit down, or else. It's like the rest of the world. And unfortunately, I think Russia made a decision a long time ago, certainly since it got control of itself again when Putin came into office, that the last time they were going to allow that to happen was with Operation Barbarossa, that they weren't going to allow anyone to come in and kill 20 or 30 or 40 million Russians again without taking a lot of people out at the head end. And so as they push more aggressively against Russia, And again, I'll remind that what they were doing essentially...
20 seconds, Don.
Wargaming from the Baltics to Korea. Wargame means you start an invasion and stop at the border. The other country has to put its defenses in motion. Well, if you do that and the other country thinks you're coming in and both sides have nuclear war, I don't know another scenario for the end of humanity, but that seems to be about as close as we've mustered so far.
Okay. An unfortunate note to end, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us. Don DeBar, activist and commentator out of New York, and out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster. And thank you so much for being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Starting under Obama and continuing under Trump, the U.S. has been heavily involved in the war on Yemen, primarily through weapon sales to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. These weapons are by and large used to intentionally target and kill Yemenis. The reality is the harrowing situation in Yemen can be directly traced back to Raytheon and other weapons manufacturers' influence on U.S. foreign policy. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Christina M. Panzica Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Yemen Crisis Linked to Weapons Maker Raytheon's Influence on U.S. Foreign Policy. Here's the second part of this article. In October 2016, news broke of Saudi Arabia striking a funeral procession in Sana'a, killing at least 140 people and injuring 500. In a largely symbolic move, the Obama administration blocked the delivery of Raytheon bomb parts that were sold but not yet shipped, citing concerns regarding Saudi Arabia's poor targeting. Raytheon's then-chief executive officer, Thomas Kennedy, personally called and lobbied Tony Blinken, the Deputy Secretary of State, and also reached out to Secretary of State John Kerry and National Security Advisor Susan Rice to express his discontent with Obama's move. While the shipment of those specific weapons was momentarily stopped, Obama continued aircraft refueling and increased intelligence sharing with Saudi Arabia. After the election of Trump, Raytheon continued to exert influence on U.S. policy. The company's first order of business was arranging several meetings between Thomas Kennedy and Trump, including during Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia in May 2017. Soon after, Trump approved the shipment of the weapons that Obama blocked. It certainly did not hurt that Raytheon had allies already embedded throughout the Washington bureaucracy. For example, the company's former chief lobbyist, Mark Esper, became Secretary of the Army and eventually Secretary of Defense from July 2019 to November 2020. During his confirmation, Esper refused to rescue himself from decisions affecting Raytheon. In addition, Acting Assistant Secretary of State Charles Faulkner had previously lobbied on defense procurement issues on behalf of Raytheon. He was eventually removed from his post for his integral role in fast-tracking $8 billion in Raytheon arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Raytheon, like other defense contractors, also employs other tactics to influence U.S. policy. One method includes hiring former State Department officials to lobby their former colleagues in the department to approve the sales Obama had blocked. These officials are not required to register as lobbyists. In its quest to guarantee Trump's approval of the weapons sales that Obama had halted, Raytheon also solicited support from lobbyist David J. Urban, who was in the same class at West Point with Mark Esper and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. They maintain strong ties and affectionately refer to themselves as West Point Mafia. Raytheon and other defense contractors also hire lobbying firms on a retainer basis to monitor legislation and step in if necessary. The two largest defense industry lobbying firms are American Defense International, ADI, and McKeon Group. McKeon Group represents not only a large percentage of the arms industry, but also the government of Saudi Arabia. McKeon Group was founded by Buck McKeon, a former House representative from California's 25th Congressional District, who served on the Armed Services Committee from 1991 until 2014. His largest campaign donors and current clients are Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, two of the largest defense contractors in the world. Simultaneously, McKeon Group lobbies on behalf of the government of Saudi Arabia, working to kill bills that would impact U.S. arms sales. Both companies, ADI and McKeon Group, have been integral to setting U.S. policy regarding Yemen. In November 2018, 2 weeks before a vote was to be held regarding the bill that would end U.S. involvement in Yemen, the McKeon Group contacted Senator Jim Inhofe, chair of the Armed Services Committee, on behalf of Saudi Arabia. Inhofe then voted in favor of continuing U.S. support of Saudi Arabia in Yemen, and the very next day, the McKeon Group donated $1,000 to the senator. Foreign Agents Registration Act records show that the company made several phone calls and sent multiple emails to a host of other members of the Senate and House regarding the bill. These lobbying companies work tirelessly to safeguard their clients' interests no matter who is in office. What's more, the countless lobbyists and officers from these companies in unelected government positions give the weapons industry a direct hand in governing and creating policy. Raytheon claims that it does not set policy but merely complies with it is immediately discredited upon examination of this web of influence within and upon the government. Because of growing public outrage at the atrocities being committed in Yemen, Raytheon and all weapons manufacturers have had to find ways to continue to rationalize their bloodstained fortunes. Given that arms manufacturers are intertwined with the U.S. government, we should remain skeptical of Biden's promise to end the war in Yemen. As demonstrated by the Obama and Trump administrations, the role of U.S. presence is to pursue a foreign policy that in large part protects and upholds the interests of the U.S. elite, including U.S. arms manufacturers. To perform this duty, Trump and Obama appointed top Raytheon executives, while members of Congress carefully heeded their guidance delivered by ADI and the McCune Group. Biden is no exception to this trend, evidenced by his nomination of Lloyd Austin. The U.S. government is a government of, by, and for corporations. The leaders of multinational corporations move continuously from industry to government and back again. The corporatocracy is often characterized by the proverbial revolving door, but in some instances, there is no door. Distinctions melt away, and corporations and government become one. Corporations like Raytheon do not, as they claim, follow U.S. foreign policy. They make it. Thus, the question at hand is not about forcing government officials to divest from any stake they have in companies they previously worked for. Nominally, cutting off ties does not indicate a divergence in interest. The U.S. government, by design, works to serve the interests of the billionaires, not the majority of the people who live paycheck to paycheck, and definitely not to bring freedom to the millions who face their bombs and boots. In order to bring an end to the genocidal war in Yemen, Americans must reckon with and fiercely oppose this reality. As people living in the U.S., Americans have a responsibility to stand up against what the U.S. government and corporations do abroad in their name. The Global Day of Action against the war in Yemen on January 25th is just one part of this. Hundreds of anti-war Yemeni and humanitarian organizations from across the world are coming together to call for an end to the genocidal war in Yemen days after Biden's inauguration and the day before Saudi Arabia's Davos in Desert Forum, where the Saudi Crown Prince will promote foreign investment in Saudi Arabia. Protests are planned across the country and the world, and an online event is being held for those who can't attend an in-person protest.